M6. Number 2A.
So we want to go through that development, and I just pinpoint the main points in regard to oneness, which I hope have also brought out in my little booklet on the development of the spiritual idea and practice. Most of what I say about this development is in that booklet, but there it is naturally much more explicit. Here I just want to bring out that development in regard to the idea of oneness. For clarity's sake, perhaps we can classify that whole development within the last 100 years in a few periods. The first one I would call the pre-Kimball period. That would be the period up to round about 1895, 6, or up to the turning of the century, before Kimball made his specific impact on the Christian Science movement. In that pre-Kimball period, we certainly didn't find much of that sense of oneness that Mrs. Eddy had seen. When we consider in which way the students of Christian Science were approaching the whole subject, they had a sense that God is good and that God is all, that even God is love. They had that sense, and that God was not good and evil, but only good, so they had that aspect of oneness, but their thinking was essential, meaning thinking is not divine mind. That they had therefore an intelligent thinker that is outside of the one mind. It wasn't the one mind that knew all ideas, it was the student who was entertaining thoughts about God. The moment you entertain thoughts about God, you certainly have a duality. It's something outside of God who tries to be in line with God and thinks about God as that God would be somewhere outside of the thinker. All the demonstrations that have been made at that time were through mental means, not through spiritual means, through thinking, not through the ideas of mind. They were great believers in the power of thought and in thought transference. So everything was based actually on a metaphysical approach. A metaphysical approach that was not the outcome of science, but that was, so to say, a higher sense of their material way of thinking. Metaphysics that rose above matter, that therefore went out from matter and rose above matter, and therefore they always tried to reason from matter to idea. They had material things and tried to see what is the idea behind it. They had experiences in the human, in the material, and tried to see what is the right thought about it. So it was all in the realm of thinking and metaphysics, but not yet in the realm of ideas. They haven't grasped yet that. It is there where Mrs. Eddy said that the works on metaphysics leave the grand point untouched. They never crown the power of mind as the Messiah. You see, they hadn't touched science, which would go out from mind and see that mind is the power in the realm of the real, whereas ordinary metaphysics, as it was really handled at that time, before the turning of the century, was to heal with the power of thinking. So we couldn't really see that was a high sense of oneness. They were thinking about God. Then we have a second period, which we can call the Kimball period, when Kimball came along and he began to try to show that we should use ideas, that God is a principle. He could see that, and try to show that principle can only be understood through the ideas that express this principle. And in spite that he had this wonderful basis and standpoint from which to go out, which was a scientific standpoint, his reasoning was not deductive. He didn't really know how to deduce from one principle two ideas. He only could state that there is a principle, and that principle can be understood through ideas, and therefore he was very hot at ideas, so to say. He was trying to bring home that everything is idea and has to be seen as idea and not so much as thinking. So he lifted the thought of the movement out, or anyway he tried to, he couldn't accomplish it entirely, he tried to lift out the movement out of the thought realm into the realm of ideas. But he could not explain what really ideas are. At that time, nobody was investigating how we can find out what the ideas of God are. They just accepted ideas and tried to see that behind every material object must be an idea, that there are as many ideas as material objects, and that therefore instead of dealing with material objects, we would have to deal with ideas. So, at that time, 1910, when John Dolly went through the normal class, the teacher class, he told us that teaching at that time consisted mostly of the question of what relationship spiritual ideas had to human beliefs. So can you see, that was the center of teaching and of contemplation, in which relationship stand ideas with human beliefs, with material things. It wasn't so much the contemplation of a principle and how principle operates through its ideas. This was unknown yet at that time. And so it needed a further development that set in round about 1914-15, when a new period started, which we perhaps can call the Bicknell-Young period, with his sense of oneness. How did it evolve? If we read today in miscellaneous writings, we find, among others, in miscellaneous writings 361-28, we find a statement which reads, God elucidates his own idea, wherein principle and idea, God and man, are not one, but are inseparable as cause and effect. If one, who could say which that one was? So you can see, this statement was written 1886, wherein Mrs. Eddy states that principle and idea are not one, that they are two. And that statement remained there, and only over 20 years later, Mrs. Eddy put into the textbook statement that was called Principle and Idea is One, and this one is God. Now, Mrs. Eddy had published the miscellaneous writing and all her other writings, as she said in the preface to miscellaneous writings, to show the steps that the movement has taken in order to show the historical development of an idea. And therefore we have always to be very careful when we read prose work, that we are aware that there are signs of their time, that they depict the mental attitude and the spiritual standpoint of that time, just as you have it, for instance, with that article, Ways That Are Vain, that was typically written out of a period of struggle and of antagonism against Christian Science, of great attack from the side of mortal mind against the idea, and afterwards she didn't want that article to be reprinted in Miscellany, but then, as you know the story, the board of directors, after the death of Mrs. Eddy, decided to put that in against her will. It shows that we should always somehow consider the whole mental atmosphere and the point of of development at a certain age in order to understand her other writings. Whereas the textbook is that book which she edited, re-edited, re-edited, corrected, corrected until the last day, so to say, in order to give us in the textbook the pure science of Christian Science. So here we had all through those 20 years the statement that principle and idea are not one, and then she changed it in 1907 into principle and idea is one. But we know now from those who have been living at that time, like Bicknell Young and John Dorley, that that statement of Mrs. Eddy in 1907 was not really noticed, that nobody really took proper notice of that new statement. And it is very interesting to read John Dorley's association reports, in which he is telling about how that new concept of oneness sprang up. He relates that in 1915, when he was preparing for his new class, that he was reading again, naturally, a recapitulation from which he had to teach, and that suddenly he could see that passage which he had, must have read many times before, but as you know from your own experience, you read something and really don't take proper notice of it, until suddenly one nice day you just feel, my golly, here it is, something terrific, and it seems as if absolutely new light would be thrown on a passage. So he relates how in preparing for that class he suddenly could see what Mrs. Eddy was stating, that she said, principle and idea is one, and that one is God, and he said that from that moment it seems that his whole attitude, his whole life, his whole teaching changed completely. He said, suddenly I could see, oh, there is only one being, and this being is all the being there is, which naturally would give a terrific answer to the general discussions in the movement, namely, what is the relationship between ideas and beliefs, ideas, belief, ideas, belief, and suddenly to see all there is the infinite one, the one being, and that's all, the only being there is. And you can see the terrific change of attitude that must have taken place. So when he saw his teacher of the normal class, Bicknell Young, soon afterwards he said to Bicknell Young, I have seen something terrific, you know, being is one. I was talking to him, and so Bicknell Young said, where did you get that from? He said, well, I got it from the textbook. And so John Dorley more or less reproached him and said, why didn't you teach us that in the normal class in 1910? And so apparently Bicknell Young, with a nice smile, said, well, we didn't know at that time. But he himself, Bicknell Young, began to see it at the same time as John Dorley was seeing. It was one of those multiple discoveries that are so well known in the world, that a new idea that is breaking in usually doesn't just come to one person, but it comes to two or more persons at the same time. And so from that time on, one could see that in the movement, the new concept that being is one was breaking in, and I think it was especially Victor Liang that specialized, so to say, on that idea and was pounding it when it into the students and into the audience of his lecture whenever he could. When one reads his association papers, one can see that they were always full just on bringing home that there is only one being, that there is only one I, that there is one ego, that there is only one mind. It's always one, 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 one. And so he had a terrific impact on the general thinking of the movement, leading the movement out of that thinking business and the argumentation business, affirming and denying in the oneness of being. You only have the one and not the two, the two. So that when Bicknell Young gave his next normal class in 1937, our friend Laurie Sintons was in that class. He came home and said, oh, it was all about the oneness and the oneness and the oneness. He was just full of the oneness. So you can see here was a man like Bicknell Young who devoted his whole life to that very progressive idea that we should no more think in a dualistic sense. He really began to show, you see, that we shouldn't think anymore in the duality of God and man. He was very hot at that thing that there is not God plus man. Cause plus effect. That cause and effect was one. That there was not a divine plus the human. That they were one. That they were not statement plus proof. That they were one. That there was not understanding plus demonstration. That understanding and demonstration was one. He just put everything right back into the oneness, into the I, into the I am, into the one ego, and into the one mind, and impressed the field, and especially a few of his students who would afterwards lead on that sense of oneness, impressed them very much. Now, in this way, he was trying to bring black thought closer to oneness, but to a mystical sense of oneness. Naturally, he called it science, and his students had a very funny way of expressing it. They said, oneness is science, and science is oneness. That's one of the great slogans of the Bicknell Young school afterwards. And naturally, this is an absolutely unscientific statement, because science is not oneness. Science is differentiation. There is no science without differentiation. And so the whole school afterwards missed the point, and therefore the whole Bicknell Young school is fiddling out. There's practically nothing left anymore today. Why? There must have been something fishy about that whole concept of oneness. Something must not have been right, you know, when something is not right, it cannot stand the stress of the time. It may take 30 years, well, it's now 40 years, it may take 40 years for something to fiddle out, which is not right. Just, so one has to be very clear that what one is doing in the science of being, if one is really building on solid ground, or just on something where one is fooling oneself into thinking that something is right, and then finally, because it is not fundamentally true, it fiddles out after a while. And if we look back to the development in Christian science, we really can find a very interesting phenomena, that right from the beginning of Christian science, right back 100 years ago, there were always, so to say, special schools that were say, dissenting from Mrs. Eddy, or that they are bringing forth specific views on the textbook, and they all fiddled out or diluted it to something which has nothing anymore to do with Christian Science. Not one single school, so to say, could survive after the pioneer of that idea was no more here. So you can see that the Kimball teaching fiddled out, the Eustace teaching fiddled out, the Bicknell Young teaching is fiddling out. And the very funny thing is that actually only the Dory School could survive. Now already a whole generation since John Dory is no more here, and the idea is stronger, more scientific, more specifically presented than ever before. And therefore this is quite an interesting sign which religious historians have taken notice. They consider it as a single phenomena in the development of the movement, that for the first time something that has not been in line with the general mood, with the general trend of thought of the movement, could survive and is already now in the third generation. That already the third generation are exponent of that teaching and are evolving the idea. Why is it? And here we find really the reason for it. You see, the idea that Bicknell Young brought with the oneness was a forward idea. Therefore it must be accepted as a terrific contribution. But it was lacking something. And one always has to see what was lacking in order not to fall into the same trap. The Bicknell Young school was an undifferentiated oneness. Everything was just one. And it was not differentiated, meaning that it didn't have a science in it. It had, and if there is no science in oneness, then it is a mystical sense of oneness. Naturally, they would never have accepted that it was mysticism that they were teaching. They would have been furious. But the analysis of it is that they didn't have a science in it. Therefore, the very first sign one could see of the deterioration of the teaching was that they began to capitalize more and more terms. Because everything is one, you can see the logic in it, if you can call that the logic in it was that because everything is one, belongs to the one, therefore everything is God. So wisdom would be capitalized again, intelligence was capitalized again, creator was capitalized again, consciousness was capitalized again, finally every idea was capitalized again. Whereas Mrs. Eddy said, only those who know proper capitalization have understood Christian Science. You know that article on capitalization in Miscellany. Just read it from time to time, because one always sees that students who have not understood this science, you can point them out when you read what they write. If they don't capitalize properly, you know at once that they haven't understood the signs of it. So, because they didn't have signs, first of all, everything was capitalized. Second, they couldn't see any more the logic in the text. And so they began to criticize the textbook as being dualistic, that it is mixing up the divine and the human. That they had that Mrs. Eddy makes a difference between life and death, and therefore establishing a dualistic sense. Because if there is only one thing, then you can have only life, and therefore death they would call no death. No dash death. Huh? Well, you can see you soon get into the wilderness of semantics, where you either say, do we have a definition for a term or not? Is actually lack, they call no lack. Well, what's the use of it? Can you see that what was missing is that they didn't have a conceptual differentiation of the subject. They misunderstood reality with concepts, because reality is only one nature and reality only knows life and no death. They made no differentiation between reality and conceptual thinking, and so they put the concepts also into the oneness and had no lack, no death, and therefore they wiped out every differentiation. But science is that which asks for more and more and more differentiation, because only through more and more differentiation we can understand the subject. If a subject has no differentiation, it is an amorphous subject, and can you understand an amorphous subject? You can't. Science, in its own nature, through its own definition, would say that you take a big subject and begin to differentiate it by building categories and classification and laws that rule the interrelationship of categories and so on. You get more and more complex structures. That's science. But what they did the very opposite. They pulled down every differentiation until they finally had only one thing, blah, blah. And so one can see that their slogan, which they put into their books, oneness is science, and science is oneness, is absolutely unscientific. Oneness is science, but science is differentiated oneness. And science demands differentiation. And this is the point where we have to set in, that we really must see oneness as a structured, differentiated oneness.